Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with translator K210 DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
Bonjour, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo. Today, we're revisiting a great chat that my co-host and sister, Leah Lem, had with Alexandria Buffalo Head. Alex is from the Sistinwap Nayote and is the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute, also known as NACD. She is also an artist, curator, and musician. Alex talks about what drives her work in the nonprofit world at NACD and how she strives to find a good work-life balance to leave time for her many outside pursuits. This episode originally aired in August of 2025 while I was out on parental leave. This is a great one, and I'm glad Leah kept things going while I was away. Enjoy the episode.
It's this thing that I'm really appreciative and grateful for, to meet others who play music, because I feel like everyone in a way can be gifted. Everyone can learn, or I feel like if you have discipline, if you just put the time into it and practice, I think you can do it with the tools that are out there with YouTube and whatnot. I'm really grateful to have it be part of my life.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining me today. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have great conversations with wonderful guests from a bunch of different backgrounds, healthcare advocates, educators, language warriors, musicians, you name it. We have a wonderful mixture of passions on the program, and we talk with folks about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. So it's another day, another opportunity to amplify Native voices and talking to a fellow musician. Always exciting. I'm speaking with Alexandra Buffalo Head. Alex Buffalo Head is from the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, and she's the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute. She's also an artist, a curator, and a musician. And we talk about her time in her parents' band and her band, and more about art curating, and of course, about her position. Hey, Alex.
Hello.
Bonjour, Alex Buffalo Head. Can you introduce yourself and tell me where you're joining us from?
I'm Alex Buffalo Head. I'm Dakota, enrolled in Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, and I am speaking from St. Paul, Minnesota, Imnijashka.
Is there anything that you are thinking about these days that's kind of top of mind?
My day job is I'm the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute, located on Franklin Avenue in the yellow building where Powell Grounds is. And we, I think for this past year, have been, or maybe it's a little bit longer, are one of three partners, Native-led organizations in the region that make up the Good Relatives Collaborative. And so right now we're in the process of listening to folks. I believe the Good Relatives Sacred Pite Resource Center, who's based in North Dakota, and Four Bands Community Fund, who's in, I believe, Eagle Butte, South Dakota, responded to a call to help administer the Bush Prize and the Good Relatives grants. We've been hearing from CUNY members this past week of their presentations for the Bush Prize honoring and guiding our review panel of community members. What's on top of mind is just how do we get more funding into these Native-led, Native-serving organizations in our region and across Indian country. And there's just so many people doing incredible work. So I'm just like, how do we network and bring people together and continue to support folks that are doing great work?
Have you come up with any solutions to that question?
Well, The Good Relatives Collaborative hosts a convening for Good Relatives grantees. And so we're trying to think of how do we maybe invite folks that we know to meet grantees and whatnot. Questions of how do we make it accessible to more, whatever I can do to introduce people, or if folks want to introduce themselves to me and I can help bring people together, let's do it.
Well, let's talk about you, Alex, a bit. You're the Director of Communications and Partnerships at NACTI and All My Relations Arts in Minneapolis. What does that gig mean?
For me, it means being part of a team. NACTI works in arts and culture, civic engagement, food sovereignty, and community engagement. And so it's working with our team to help figure out how we can try and best tell our story and uplift community members, artists, entrepreneurs, makers, to just elevate them and to invite community members to our programs and events and support partners and other Native Orgs events, kind of marketing, promo, communication, storytelling, and working in community with community events. And yeah, I've been at NACTI for 7 years now. Kind of have a background in arts. I feel like arts helped me get through school. I was kind of not like a naughty student, but for me, I had more fun drawing and paying more attention when things were kind of related to our community. And so that I feel like helped me graduate, kind of applying that love for art to other areas and just trying to bring that back and support other artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I definitely see your press releases a lot. They come through. So good work. Can you maybe bring me through an example of one of those programs that NACTI works on? Maybe something that you're really proud of?
I mean, I'm proud of all of our programs. Our Make Voting a Tradition program, Jolene Jones is the manager. She's Anishinaabe and she's a community organizer and wears many hats. But what we've been trying to do is combine our arts program with our civic engagement work to get out the vote. And so what we've been finding is when we work with artists to do arts messaging work, folks are more excited about seeing images of folks wild ricing or things related to families where it's imagery that looks like our people and community members. And they're more, I don't know, more willing to talk about voting and the importance of it and the impacts on our communities for those who represent us. We're just gearing up for the November elections. We held a mayoral forum. It was just really exciting to see that kind of perspective working with other partners. We worked with the American Indian OIC and they hosted it. And so just having community members be able to ask questions of the candidates and how they're going to support a community was just a really incredible event where we were able to table. There's other community partners, Native and non-Native, who were able to table and just really bring people together.
Mm. Do you mainly focus on Minneapolis then?
Yes, and Make Voting a Tradition has been working to expand statewide efforts. So to help folks in tribal communities for tribal elections, trying to be more in St. Paul. So we've been tabling more. We were at the Food Truck Festival recently by Heard Island, and that was an incredible event. So yeah, we are trying to expand our reach beyond just Minneapolis and East Phillips neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And what are some challenges then, getting people out to vote?
Just politically how things are, people are really frustrated and continue to not trust the government. And I feel like for valid reasons. And with these upcoming local elections, it's just ways that we can hopefully elect folks that are in relationship with us and hear us and will continue to be in relationship versus other folks who maybe don't have us as part of their best interests. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of mistrust and younger generations, I think, are really frustrated. I mean, everyone, I feel like, is really, really frustrated, and we need to continue to work together. We need to organize, continue to show up, and however we're able to hold our elected officials accountable when they are coming to our community. So not only in just election seasons, but continuing to show up for us. I think that's really important.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting a chat that my co-host and sister, Leah Lem, had with Alexandria Buffalohead. Alex is from the Siston Wahpeton Ayote and is the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute, also known as NACDI.
Well, tell me, Alex, how did you get into this line of work?
I feel like seeing my mom work in nonprofits, that kind of inspired me. I didn't know how or what. And so I was really honored to work at the Indian Land Tenure Foundation as my first kind of grown-up position. And then I worked at the American Indian Cancer Foundation. I arrived at NACDI, and I don't know, I wanted to be part of something in community, serving our Native folks, things that are important to me, like our arts, our access to food, affordable foods, voting rights. Yeah, and in a way, NACDI, I feel like we try and support folks in their careers of, I don't know, giving them opportunities that maybe they might not have. So I feel like I've, I don't know, professionally grown a lot and appreciate the support.
Very cool. So maybe tell me about younger Alex. Like, what were your interests and hobbies, and have you kept them up?
So younger hobbies, I feel like making art, which I kind of on and off do. Music is and still is a big part of my life. I joined my parents' band when I was 15. They were playing a gig and I was in choir and had done some like piano lessons. But I don't know, my piano teacher said like, hey, I don't think she's interested in it. So maybe you should stop doing the lessons. And they're like, yeah, it's kind of expensive. So they stopped. And so with this gig, they're like, okay, after we played it, I was just like, I had the music bug of just hearing the music and singing. I feel like there's healing properties when you sing, of like relaxing your vagus nerve, which I've been hearing more often. And so they're like, ask your dad to help you with some chord progressions. And I'm like, okay. And so from there on, I've just been fortunate to be on this journey of meeting so many different folks and musicians and community members, having the honor to share music with folks. And it's still a big passion of mine. And in a way, I feel like it kind of bleeds into my day job of the folks that I've met and trying to network and support each other. And yeah, things that I've learned has kind of transferred from the like music world to nonprofit world of trying to find spaces for folks to have opportunities to share their art.
Why don't you give us a little like lowdown breakdown of the band?
Yeah.
What's called? Who's in it?
The band's name is Blue Dog. And so my parents formed it, I believe, in 2001. I think my mom wanted to use the name Black Dog for the Dakota Village, but it's a common name for Led Zeppelin song and I think a beer brand. And so she asked her aunties if she could do Blue Dog. It's the name of a lake in Sisseton, and they gave their blessing. We've actually met the Blue Dog family, which has been really cool. Yeah, my dad, I feel like growing up, he always was in different cover bands and he was in a band. And I think there's a point where we told our mom, like after hearing her sing, like, hey, you should join the band. And so she did, with playing congos and whatnot. They write most of the music, the melodies and lyrics. And as I've gotten older, I've been able to help contribute. And we've actually received a couple of grants from the Tiwahe Foundation and First Peoples Fund to record and purchase merch. And my keyboard that I have, I'm so grateful for, was a grant through the Tiwahe Foundation. So I feel like we've really been blessed by different Native organizations to help support us. And so we've been able to record and
it's kind of like blues rock.
Yeah, it's blues rock. I feel like we're influenced by like Santana, a lot of folks, blues players. My parents were really interested in researching kind of the similarities of how African slaves were brought over and didn't have their drum and shared it with Indigenous people here, and how their songs blended together. We're honored to be part of, I believe it's like a PBS, I don't know, fundraiser or something, celebrating Link Ray and the documentary Indians Who Rock the World. And so I feel like if folks want to learn more, that's a really great resource on the history of different Indigenous performers in the blues and how it's influenced rock and whatnot. So I feel like that has been really instrumental, I don't know, in my inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And just growing up listening to blues and rock and R&B.
Right on. And have you written any songs?
I have written one song. It's called Working for the Man. It was before I worked for nonprofit, so it's not about any of my current or recent jobs. But really, I just wanted to write something that was positive and just, I think for myself and for others, of like, it's okay if you're not doing what you love, but or like right now, but if you can keep fighting to do something that you're passionate about, then it like works. And also like a way to like stick it to the man of like a protest. So yeah. And instrumentally, I feel like, I don't know, my parents, we've recorded in different ways of, I feel like my mom just like records the lyrics or melodies on her phone. And then she shares it with my dad, who then takes his guitar and then kind of pieces them together. And in our most recent album, they did that. And then we were introduced to Keith Cicola and had him come over and just kind of jam with us. And so the four of us just like spent time and just the songs just started coming in kind of a weird kind of jam way. And I don't know, like when we play our songs, I feel like they just keep getting better of like albums. Yes, in a way for us, they're just like a moment in time. We're fortunate of the more we play it, or I don't know, there's some bands people want to hear it exactly as how you hear it on the radio. And then I feel like there's folks like B.B. King. He had a quote or something of like, it's like a special in the moment kind of thing. And so I really just connect with that of how, in a way, it's like you're experiencing this place that you go to. And I feel like that's kind of what Keith Cicola would share, of like you go on this kind of place, or you're transported to a place with the musicians and listeners.
Is any of that recorded?
It's on our most recent album called Take a Stand, inspired by No Dapple and whatnot. I think it was finished either right before 2020, maybe 2019. There's an artist from Southwest who did the album cover. Yeah, I think Keith, and there's a couple other guests, Angie, and I think Ted Vig, who run Vig Guitars. They're featured on the album as guests, and there might be a couple others.
Well, what does it feel like then being a musician? What inspires you? How do you connect to your music side?
In a way, it's kind of like reading, but with sound. Of like, it transports you to a different place. And for me, in a way, it's kind of like wearing another hat. I would just get so nervous, almost like pretty much sick to my stomach, because of just being in front of others. And with time, I feel like learning how to breathe better, just feeling more confident, practicing more, I still get nervous. And I feel like that's just who I am, or just a place of I'm really excited to be doing what we're doing and want to just do my best that I can. It's this thing that I'm really appreciative and grateful for, to meet others who play music, because I feel like everyone in a way can be gifted. Everyone can learn, or I feel like if you have discipline, if you just put the time into it and practice, I think you can do it with, I don't know, the tools that are out there with YouTube and whatnot. I'm really grateful to have it be part of my life.
Yeah. What's your practice schedule like, rehearsal schedule?
I feel like it used to, for like decades, it was every Friday. And so it's kind of gotten a little bit more laxed, and I need to be more disciplined in practice. So yeah, I feel like in the summers we kind of slow down with practice schedules because we're more performing. And then in the winter time is where we practice, where we try new cover songs, where we try writing new music. So kind of just as we're bunkered down in the cold, but also we're always happy to bring out our gear in a snowstorm and play a show.
Mm-hmm. Fun. Well, why don't we pivot then to some of your curator work? Is that part of your gig now?
I haven't been doing as much curation. I have like one project kind of pending. In a way, curation is storytelling, and kind of like music, I feel like there should be opportunities for everyone to have access to tell their stories and to highlight artists. It feels kind of like a networking tool as well, of if artists are shown more in a way professionally, they can do better. So it's like finding opportunities to try and support others' work. I don't know. It's an exciting thing, especially with artists that I'm fans of. I feel like all the artists that I work with, I'm big fans of their work. It's challenging. I find that I think museums are trying to do different, but I feel like they're being impacted politically. Mm-hmm. So things, I feel like they keep changing back and forth of when it's trendy to support Indigenous artists, or if they, for sure, it's in their DNA of an institution to support Native artists at all levels of leadership. Yeah, depends on the place. And I feel like spaces like All My Relations Arts Gallery and Two Rivers Galleries are just so vital to our community to support emerging and artists of all ages so that they can learn from each other and communities can see themselves and see folks that they might know. And just, yeah, museums are an interesting, or like preservation of art. Museums are such a fascinating thing. It's kind of like a weird relationship, similar to monuments too, of it kind of has like a weird history, European history, and how things get indigenized or changed is really fascinating to me. I think I'm more interested in ways of how do you make people feel safe or feel comfortable in art spaces or public art, how folks can feel seen, since I feel like often Native folks we're fighting to have representation.
Mm-hmm. And you've worked mainly with Native artists on?
Yeah, I almost feel like I've maybe only worked with Native artists. The last show I curated was with Michaela Patton and Jada Gray Eagle. Both are phenomenal artists, and I feel like they're continuing to just grow in their careers. Check them out if you haven't heard of them. Jada is a photographer, and I feel like she's been a producer for documentary, among many other things. And Michaela Patton is doing several residencies where she makes her own paper and makes these parfleche boxes and incorporates quills and beadwork and mixed media. They're just both incredible artists. It's tricky to balance and juggle things, so I'm learning I can maybe do one a year or maybe every couple of years. And it's also taught me a lot about project management and having to plan backwards, which can be fun and can be hard.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting a chat that my co-host and sister, Leah Lem, had with Alexandria Buffalohead. Alex is from the Sistan-Wahpeton Iote and is the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute, also known as NACDI.
What would you describe what the role of a curator is?
I would hope it'd be somebody that is, in a way, just a supporter of the artist. I feel like there's different ways to approach it. I try to ask the artists how they want to be presented, what they want to show. It can depend on if the artist is making new works or if it's from their portfolio. The role of a curator should come from a place of care for the artist and for their artwork.
Is there a way that curating challenges you?
For me, it's hard writing with the artist a statement that it's like a statement that feels very permanent, where like on websites or social media, you can sometimes edit things and change things. And with time, your ideas grow and change, and maybe you disagree with yourself in a statement. And so in a way, I feel like it's challenging of you have to write something and stand by it for at least that portion of the exhibition, which I feel like can be done because it's such a collaborative thing with the artists and usually the staff of the gallery or the team there. I feel like sometimes it can be challenging working in non-Native spaces of translating or having to advocate for the artists, which I'm happy to do. I want to do for folks because I want folks to work with us. So that can be a challenge. Time can always be a challenge, budgeting, because there's not a lot of funding available for curation. Like some typical gallery shows, artists don't even get paid to show their art, and they put years or hours into their artwork. And if they're not selling it, in a way, it's just kind of recognition. But I could be mistaken. I'm sure artists maybe have different perspectives on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any mentors?
Ooh, that is a good question. My parents are definitely mentors. I always go to them. Jim Denemy was a mentor. He passed a couple years ago. I was always inspired by his art. He really influenced me to paint with other colors, like not as kind of realist looking, but being open to different colors and just his way of storytelling.
Wonderful. Well, we also like to ask, you know, if there are people out there listening or youth and want to kind of maybe follow a similar path to you, like maybe with curation or, you know, working in the arts, like, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I would say, I feel like this is what was kind of passed on to me of like, if it's something you're passionate about versus like, I don't know if you're considering maybe it doesn't make enough money or whatnot, I feel like go for it. Network, introduce yourself, even though maybe it doesn't feel very comfortable. Yeah, just showing up. I feel like in the arts community, just going to events, you kind of seem the same suspects or folks that go to art gallery openings in the community. So yeah, introduce yourself. I'd say, I don't know, I feel like school education is really important. That's something that can't be taken away. So just be open to all learning opportunities that, I don't know, folks that if you like their artwork, reach out to them, ask them questions. Curation, I feel like it's this, I don't know, it's this weird thing in that if you want to go like the traditional route, folks need to be open to moving across the country. I feel like folks maybe kind of stay in their positions for a while and there's not as many openings. So you kind of see like in our state, you see kind of similar folks and they just kind of rotate jobs, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But for kind of emerging positions, I feel like folks should be willing or open to travel, which can be hard if you have family.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, tell me, just is there anything else you have planned then for the summer or fall, whether with your work or personally?
Let's see. The rest of the summer, we have a couple of gigs coming up that I'm excited for. There's this place in St. Croix called the Brookside, and I'm pretty sure it's Native recently, within the past couple of years, Native owned. They just started having music back this summer, and so I'm excited to play that. And then at my work, weekly on Thursdays, we have the Four Sisters Farmers Market, and so it's open 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we have different programming events happening each week. So I guess monthly, we have our Alma Relations artist in resident, Wukuyewi. She's doing different monthly activities at the farmer's market. So I encourage folks to try and see when she'll be doing a workshop with folks. I think we have like a plant dyeing session. And then in the fall, October, there's going to be an exhibition at Alma Relations Arts called Matrilineal. Oh, no. Actually, I'm saying it wrong. Hold on. Michaela Schaefer, who is Hopi and lives in Seattle, is going to be having a solo exhibition. So we're really excited to host that at Alma Relations Arts Gallery. And we hope folks will get out and vote and see make voting a tradition at our farmers market or community events. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat today. Sounds like you live a wonderfully creative life.
Thank you. Really appreciate speaking with you. Thank you.
All right. That was Alex Bufflohead. Alex is from the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, and she's the Director of Communications and Partnerships at the Native American Community Development Institute. And, you know, I'm just really excited, as always, to speak with a fellow musician, you know, hearing what inspires them, and what kind of collaborations are going on, and yeah, how one incorporates art into their everyday life. So, Chi Miigwech, Alex Bufflohead. I'm Leah Lam. Miigwech for listening. Gigababin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, nature nerds, and welcome to the Season Watch podcast. I am Charlie Mitchell. That was the sound of some barred owls caterwauling. And I am excited for it to be another week in June. This week, we've got a very jam-packed Season Watch podcast for you. We're going to start off with a report from Josh Leonard from the Bellin Outdoor Science Project. Here we go.
Okay, Season Watch, this is my last school year report here from Bellin Outdoor Science. Today is the last day of school, June 12th, for St. Paul Public Schools. So here we go from Bellin Outdoor Science near Afton, Minnesota. On Monday, June 8th, we had ground cherry blooming, kinnikinick dewberry blooming. It looks like a strawberry plant, but the berries look like blackberries or raspberries. We had a large painted turtle laying eggs. Narrow leaf hawk's beard was blooming. I really want to know what beard means for flowers because it doesn't seem beard-like at all. And, you know, like penstemon can also be called a large flowered beard tongue. I think that's weird how beard gets woven into flower names of all things. Prairie alum root was blooming. Prairie phlox was blooming. And we also had woolly milkweed blooming. I posted that on iNaturalist a year or two ago, and a professor showed up from Chicago to take a picture of it. I'm pretty sure it was the woolly milkweed. It could have been another one that's in the same area. Let's see. We found a hognose snake shed on Tuesday, June 9th. Mourning dove fledgling was seen walking around on the ground, and we didn't know what to do with it. Poor thing. It fledged too early or left the nest too early. Also on Tuesday, June 9th, we had a Blanding's turtle. We have the rare Blanding's turtle here on site at Bellin, and it likely laid eggs on Tuesday, June 9th. We have this wonderful person, Jim Rue, who follows her around at midnight, 1 in the morning, making sure that she's laying her eggs and where the nest is so that he can protect it from nest predators. And this year is one of 2 years out of the past, maybe 15, that she gave Mr. Rue the slip. So she moves away from the pond to lay her eggs and then like way up onto the hilltop. And then she returns to the slough, and he found her in the slough on the morning of Wednesday, June 10th. So we're bummed that we don't know where the nest is, but hopefully she will have a successful nesting season. Also wanted to point out that an invasive called Grecian foxglove was blooming. If you go to remove it, make sure you're wearing gloves because that can have a chemical in it that can stimulate your heart, I believe. And then also, we're just so thankful for the rain that we've had this week. We had 0.3 inches yesterday on June 11th, and then we had 0.34 inches on June 10th, and a smattering of other rain earlier this week. And so thankful for the cooler temperatures as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Josh. I did a very fast Google while I was listening to that, and the beard in many plant names comes from some hairy basically little hairy parts of the plant might give the plant the name beard. So in the case of the hawk's beard, there are some hairy parts to the flower or the inflorescence that gives it hawk's beard. I don't know about hawk, but that's some research for another day. I loved the story, of course, about the Blanding's turtles. If you don't know the Blanding's turtle, they are an endangered, or at least species of concern in Minnesota. They are gorgeous, very dark turtles with more of a rounded shell than we think of for, you know, our painted turtles or our snapping turtles. And they have this just beautiful, bright yellow chin. And they live, they're more of a wetland species than a riverine species. So preferring kind of slower moving backwaters, and absolutely a joy to see one of those. And especially to know that there's one nesting at Bellin. That is such a gift to know. I know they are not having a good time in terms of their population. So glad to hear one is out there, even if it is, you know, giving you the slip. I also love the note that you posted, it was a kind of milkweed, I'm forgetting the name, but you posted it on iNaturalist and had someone travel across the country to see it. How awesome is that? Thank you, iNaturalist, for all of these cool interactions that we get to have. So those were our voice memos, a nice little appetizer for our podcast this week. And for our main course, we have this interview with Thea Evans, who is talking about wasps and bees that use dead and declining trees.
I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer, and today we continue our conversation about the natural world and our series on critters that use dead and declining trees in the forest. The series produced by Mark Jacobs, and today we are featuring Thea Evans. She is the project coordinator for the Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas, and we'll be learning more about bees and wasps in the forest. Thea, thanks for being with us, and Mark, thanks for joining us via phone.
Thanks, Heidi.
Yep.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Mark. Morning, Thea. Nice to see you both. Well, I don't see you, Mark, but I know what you look like, so you're in my head. Yeah.
Well,
renting space.
Thea, let's start off with, what is the Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas?
The Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas is a citizen science project. We're dedicated to learning about the bees that nest in dead wood and plant stems. Our goal is to learn about where these bees live in Minnesota and what their habitat needs are. And we're currently working on several projects that are funded by a grant from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund.
Very cool. Citizen science. So who's involved and how does one get involved?
Yeah, this is a statewide program. So we have volunteers all over the state who are working on this project with us. It started in 2016. And we have these bee blocks that we send to people all over the state, and they hang them out in a natural or semi-natural area. And then they monitor them for the nesting activity of bees and wasps that come to nest in them. And then they can log that information on our website, and we learn about where the different bees live and what their phenology is. So like what time of year they're active, what kinds of nest parasites might be interacting with them, all sorts of interesting stuff. And we have a website, which is minnesotabeeatlas.umn.edu. And that is a great place to find more information about the project. And it has a lot of information about our results so far, and also about future potential volunteer opportunities.
Now, is that, just to be clear, that's Minnesota Bee Atlas, all one word, and Minnesota is written out? It's not MNB Atlas, it's Minnesota Bee Atlas.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, good. All right. Well, then we'll have that up on our website, too, for those of you who are interested. A few years ago, we talked to a woman about bees, and I was alerted to the fact that red elderberry, if you cut the branches, trim the branches, that the bees will use those. And I did that, and the bees did use them. Just one example, but those are live trees, and you're talking about dead trees. Would it be the same sort of bees that are using elderberry as a place to lay their egg? Or are there different? I know there are thousands of different kinds of bees. It's a bit daunting when you get into it.
Yeah, we do have a really diverse bee population. We have about 500 species of bees just in Minnesota. And the bees that would nest in like cut elderberry stems, and they'll nest in other types of cut stems as well, are small carpenter bees usually. There are some others that will as well. And they really like the plant stems that have some pith in the middle, and they kind of construct the inside of the nest with that plant pith. They don't tend to nest in dead wood. So there's kind of a different set of bees that would be nesting in the dead wood.
And can you describe some of those? I mean, what would I be looking at if I were seeing a bee in dead wood? And are these like standing trees, or do they care if the tree blows down? Is that as good a home for them?
Yeah, there are, you know, many different species, and as well as the bees that nest in dead wood, there's, and equal or maybe larger number of wasps that also nest in deadwood. So the different species have different habitat requirements, and they, you know, different places that they like to nest. So on the bee side, we have many species of leafcutter bees, many mason bee species, little tiny yellow-faced bees often nest in deadwood. So there are quite a few different types of bees, ranging from really tiny to pretty big. Some of them like to excavate into rotting wood, and they'll kind of dig their own nest tunnel into rotting wood. Some of them like fresher wood, and they'll rely on a tunnel maybe that's made by another insect, wood-boring insect, into that wood. So kind of having different, different deadwood and different stages of decay is helpful for the different species. It can be dead branches on living trees that they might utilize. It could be standing dead trees. It could be logs on the ground. And all of those could be habitat for bees or wasps, and different species of them.
You've mentioned bees and wasps a couple of times now, and I feel as though I might know the difference, but how would just a person who is maybe not familiar with them recognize one from the other? Is there, how do I know that's a bee and that's a wasp? Or is it not that simple?
They're really closely related.
Yeah, they are.
Bees evolved from wasps, and they tend to be a little hairier. That's one way that people often distinguish them. It's not always true. There are some bees that aren't very hairy, and some wasps that are a little more hairy, but that's one way. But I think the main difference is that bees collect pollen and nectar, and that's what they feed to their young. And wasps are predators, so they collect usually other types of insects or arthropods, so often caterpillars or aphids or spiders.
I was going to say spiders, yeah. I saw a bee, a wasp, take a spider one day and drag it across the sand and I suppose lay an egg in it or something and hope to feed its young. Yeah. So those, if it's predatory, it tends to be more likely a wasp than a bee.
Yeah, for sure. Bees are only collecting pollen and nectar. Adult wasps will visit flowers for the nectar for themselves. And I think there are some pollen collecting wasps also, but for the most part, what they're collecting to feed their young are other insects and arthropods.
So let's say I started this, joined the group and said, yeah, I want to do, but I don't know, I don't have a good book on bees and wasps. What do I do? Take a picture and send it to you guys and you'll go, oh, that's that wasp or that's that bee. Is that how that works?
Well, I love it when people take pictures and send them to us. I can't promise that we can totally identify it from a picture, but you can also, it's great to take pictures and post them to iNaturalist. You can often get pretty good identifications that way.
Right.
There's a Minnesota Bee Atlas project on iNaturalist. And a lot of really experienced bee identifiers go through that project and identify bees. So that's a pretty great place to post your pictures and learn about what you're seeing. It is pretty difficult often to identify bees and wasps to species just from a photograph. There's some exceptions. Bumblebees can be a little bit easier to identify that way. I often, you know, if I was looking at a picture, I might be able to say it's, you know, it's in this kind of group of bees. This is a leafcutter bee or this is a mason bee or that kind of thing.
We did just get a text in from Chris. She said, I have cedar posts around my garden. If I drill holes in it, will bees be interested?
That's very likely that they will be interested. Yeah, they're drilling holes in posts can definitely attract bees that like to nest in those tunnels. And that could be great for your garden, you know, and you also may get some of those solitary wasps nesting in there. And they're the solitary wasps that nest in those kind of tunnels are also very gentle, just like the solitary bees, and they will, provide some pest control in your garden. So they're also really beneficial insects to have there.
Yeah. So can you talk about, the one I'm familiar with is, I don't know if it was a leaf cutter, because I was cutting up 100-inch logs into firewood and splitting them. And I split one, and in there about 2 inches deep in the wood was this little plug of green material, which I took to be leaves. And so I'm sure I upset somebody's home, but what sort of bee or wasp can you describe some of the common ones that might be out there?
Sure. That definitely sounds like a leaf cutter bee nest that you found in the log, which is pretty neat. The leaf cutter bees are, they're generally kind of medium sized bees. They can get on the bigger side, but kind of medium to big bees, and they collect pollen on the underside of their abdomen. So if you see them out and about at flowers, they will often have like bright yellow or bright white kind of pollen all over their underside of their abdomen, which makes them really kind of easy to pick out. Otherwise, they're kind of stripey, like a bee.
Right.
And
warning.
Warning. Yeah. And so that's the leaf cutter bees are one type. Mason bees are out in the early spring, so we usually start seeing them in even as early as April, May, June, and they're usually done nesting by June. They are kind of this metallic dark blue or blue green color generally, and they're usually pretty fuzzy as well. And they can be, we have the orchard mason bee, which is a pretty big, it's a pretty good sized bee, but I guess in the range of bees, it's probably medium sized. And then there are a number of smaller ones that can be pretty small, but they still have that like kind of metallic blue-green sheen to them. They also collect pollen on the underside of their abdomen as well, so that's another kind of way to distinguish them. But they'll be active earlier in the season than the leaf cutter bees. The leaf cutter bees tend to be out in midsummer. The yellow faced bees are really tiny bees. They almost look like little tiny flying ants. They're mostly black, but if you can look at them, if you can get up close enough to them, you can see that they have these really distinctive triangular yellow marks on their face. And and they don't have very much hair on them at all. So that's another thing that makes them look more sort of ant-like or wasp-like. But you would tend to see them on the types of flowers that have really open petals, maybe umbel-shaped flowers. Mm-hmm. There are the wasps that might nest in deadwood are often potter wasps. So they're going to collect mud to build the inside of their nest, and they look a lot, they're in the same family as like yellow jackets and hornets. So they kind of look like that. They're yellow and black, and they have that waspy look to them. But they're solitary wasps. They're quite gentle, and there are many, many species of them.
You've mentioned now a couple of times that many of these bees are, when you say gentle, when I talk to people, I tell them these bees don't sting. These are not the kind of bees that are going to sting you. Is that what you mean when you say gentle? Are most of these bees not equipped with stingers or just reluctant to sting you?
Yeah, that is what I mean. They are reluctant to sting you. They do have stingers. The females have stingers. The males don't. So the females can sting, but they are really not interested in stinging. So they're When I say they're solitary bees, that means that each female mates and builds her own small nest that maybe has like 1 to 15 eggs in it. And she's doing all the work of that nest building. She's gathering the material to make the nest. She's guarding the nest entrance. She's laying the eggs. She's gathering all the food that she's going to feed to the babies. So she's, if something happens to her, that's it. She doesn't have any workers to like help her out. So she's really not interested in conflict or stinging. She'll just avoid you as much as possible. I've held these kind of solitary bees in my hand without being stung. They're very, the only time I think they would sting is if you kind of put your hand on them in a way, like if you accidentally put your hand down onto them.
Right.
They might sting you.
I got stung by a bumblebee once when I stepped on one, but other than that, I can't ever remember being stung by a bumblebee. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, see, I was involved in your project for several years, and I just wondered, what have you learned from it, from the Citizen Science Project? Anything surprising or?
Well, we've learned a lot about, we started out not even knowing exactly what species were in Minnesota or where they lived within the state. So we were able we've been able to really map out where some of the different species live and see, like, there are some species that kind of range over the whole state. There are some that are really concentrated in one part of the state. We were able to document several new species that we didn't know were here. So that was pretty exciting. Several of them were bees that had previously only been known in areas a little bit south of here. So we don't know whether they had always been in Minnesota, but they were kind of rare and nobody had found them before, or if they are moving north as the climate warms. We've also learned quite a bit about their nesting biology. So we've learned a lot about the different interactions that happen within the nest. There are, along with the nest building bees and wasps, there are also many, many species of parasitic wasps and parasitic bees actually too. And they're, you know, they're a normal part of the bee and wasp community. So we've been able to, learned some things about those relationships, which has been really interesting. There was actually a student at the university who started a project looking at cuckoo wasps and their hosts using the data from our project, which was really cool. And that project has continued. There's a whole class around that now, kind of looking at that data. They found some new species. They've been able to show that there are really specific host and parasite relationships. So that's been pretty neat.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What can I do as a homeowner that will help these bees and wasps?
Well, the main thing I think is to leave some dead wood in the landscape. And that could be dead branches or standing dead trees. My parents actually, they had a pine tree that died. It was near their garden, and they, instead of cutting the whole thing down, they just kind of cut the big branches off of it and left the main trunk standing. And that trunk stood for probably 15 or 20 years. And then it started to get a little unstable, and they cut it down and left the logs lying on the ground. And when the logs were lying on the ground, you could see that it was inhabited, all the sections of that big trunk of the pine tree were inhabited by these green sweat bees that were making nests in the log.
Nice. So
it was, you know, it was this incredible bee habitat. So if you have an opportunity like that to leave a dead tree in the landscape, I think that can be really beneficial. Or, you know, if it feels like it's safer, it makes more sense to cut a section and leave some dead wood as a log instead, that's also great. And then the other kind of main thing is to plant flowers for the bees. So the bees, as I said, they really rely on pollen and nectar. And there are so many different species of bees. They're active at different times of the season. So having flowers blooming throughout the whole growing season is really important for them. And then the other thing I would say is that just to be really careful about the use of insecticide, especially the kind of systemic insecticides that will go into the whole plant and can go into the pollen and nectar. So just reducing that use or eliminating it entirely, I think is also really important for the bees.
And especially since some of those bees are actually, hunting the insects you're trying to get rid of. So yeah, it is a good idea to refrain.
Well, thank you so much, Thea. That's Thea Evans, Project Coordinator for the Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas. More information at minnesotabeeatlas.umn.edu. And thanks to Mark Jacobs for producing this segment as well. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. It was wonderful.
Thanks.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but I found that absolutely fascinating. I love, when I was growing up, I just thought of bees as honeybees and bumblebees, and maybe those are the same things, but finding out we have over 500 species in the state, and they're all so different. They all use the environment in such different ways and have such cool nesting habits, and I love it. I love it so much. And then finding out about all the wannabes, the little flies that mimic bees, and the wasps. Man, yeah, I think entomologists have their work cut out for them. There is a whole world there that we don't know about. So thank you so much, Thea Evans, for that one. And for dessert for our podcast, we have this adorable, wonderful, brings me so much joy talkback from Zeta.
Today is June 14th, 2026, Saturday. And I seen a real crayfish. I never saw a real crayfish. It's blue, tan, and it's white, too. It probably is coming back.
And where are we at?
And where we are at is at my... We were going camping. Aunt Michelle.
And Pingilly.
Oxide. See you soon.
Oxide Creek. Tell them.
Yep, Oxide Stream.
So what's your name?
Zeta. And this is my phonology report. Thank you.
How is that for the perfect talkback to end this rendition of the Season Watch podcast? Thank you, Zeta. Thank you, Josh Leonard and Chelsea Perkins, Thea Evans, everyone else who's contributed to this episode, including Norma Malinowski, who was the person who recorded the barred owl caterwauling. And of course, we are very eager to hear from you. Please send us a voice memo through SpeakPipe. You'll find the link in the podcast description or online at kaxe.org. We would love to hear from you and answer any questions or just hear about what you're seeing out there. Until next week. Have a good one.
Support for Season Watch Podcast comes from the Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids, a Northwoods setting on the shores of Sugar Lake, offering lodge rooms, cabins, and golf villas, with on-site dining, a golf course, and access to the lake, trails, and seasonal outdoor recreation throughout the year. Plan your stay at sugarlakelodge.com.
just before 6 o'clock.